Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Napster and its impact on the music industry. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another of our special episodes marking the 20th anniversary of CMU. If this is the first time you've tuned into one of these, this is a series of episodes in which we look back at some of the biggest music business stories we've covered in CMU's first two decades. And this one takes us back to pretty much the beginning of time slash CMU.
CMU time.
Yeah, the beginning of CMU time, not actual time.
That being 1998.
Yes, because CMU was launched, as you say, in 1998. And a year later, Napster arrived and basically shaped everything we would talk about for the next 20 years.
Certainly when it comes to recorded music. Yes. It was quite a big development that happened 13 months in. That's telling, isn't it? We launched May 1998. Napster launched in June 1999. And although actually the original iteration of Napster, which is mainly what we're talking about today, if you're a big fan of the Napster streaming service that still exists, and that's what you think we're talking about on this edition of the podcast, nobody cares about the Napster streaming service. Nobody cared about the Napster legal download service. We are talking about the original Napster, which, given its impact on the music industry and how it is still something that's talked about a lot in the music business, actually didn't exist for that long.
No.
It came, it was a global phenomenon, massive lawsuits, sued out of business. And that all happened in a really small period of time. But in that period of time, and in the story we're going to tell today, some quite big events occurred that would have a massive impact on the recorded music business, certainly for the next decade, and in many ways still to this day.
Yeah, and I'd assume that anyone listening to this show would probably have a reasonably good grasp on the general history of Napster.
Although,
already.
You're saying that ages you. Because when I go and do my CMU DIY sessions with people who are like just in university, so they're 18, 19 years old, and I talk about Napster, they don't really know what I'm talking about.
I suppose it was
20
years ago.
Because they came into file sharing. The current people going to university now, LimeWire was for them their first experience of ripping off musicians and getting a load of free music. So if you are of that demographic, Napster was the original LimeWire. That's all you need to know.
Right.
And if you're younger still, it was what predated the Pirate Bay. And if you're younger still, it's what predated Kick-Ass Torrents. And if you don't know what any of that means, you're too young to be listening to this podcast, I want you to tune out right now.
Do we have a minimum age limit?
We definitely do, and that's it.
Yeah, okay, well, in that case, we should go back to the beginning. And I mean, what I was going to say was, while I would assume that people would have a general grasp on this, although it was run for a very short amount of time, a lot happened. And researching this, there was a lot that I'd completely forgotten about. So we'll get into some of that. But basically, yeah, let's start from the beginning. So Napster was founded, as you say, in June 1999 by two teenagers, Sean Fanning and Sean Parker.
Yeah, both called Sean, although one couldn't spell his own name. Sean Fanning was S-H-A-W-N. That's no way to be spelling Sean, is it? Whereas Sean Parker, classic spelling of the name Sean. Although I have to say, although with hindsight, Sean Parker, who then obviously got involved in Facebook and subsequently was an advisor to Spotify, is often the person people now talk about. At the time, and when I was writing about this, right when it was all happening, we never talked about Sean Parker.
No.
Sean Fanning was very much the face of Napster.
Slightly unwillingly, he was quite a shy teenager and didn't really want to be the face of it. We're not really going to talk about that, but that's something that came up when I was researching this. He was very reluctant to be the face of it, and the people behind him were saying, someone has to be the face of it, and you built this, you have to do it.
And I suppose the reason why that is important to mention is neither of these guys set a bit of software intending to completely revolutionise and overhaul the record industry.
No.
They didn't intend to build a global phenomenon that would completely change the way music piracy worked. They just built a bit of software for them and their friends, and then sort of overnight, and on the last one of these, we were talking about MySpace, weren't we? And similar to MySpace, it exploded and became much bigger than anyone thought. But I think an even more surprise to the founders than MySpace was, they did not expect to create this global phenomenon that they did.
No, I mean, also Sean Fanning's uncle was in there as well. He was the guy who actually incorporated the original Napster business. But yeah, Sean Fanning and Sean Parker are the two people you really talk about when you talk about Napster. So it's basically this piece of software that allowed you to easily share music files between computers across the internet. That's what it did. It sort of, as well as allowing you to share files, it kind of, it made all of the files on your computer available to whoever wanted them within the Napster network.
Yeah, so peer-to-peer file sharing, as it became known. It wasn't the only bit of software that did this. Actually, quite a few of the companies who then ended up being sued after Napster were sort of developing their initial software around about this time. I mean, I think the original LimeWire was being developed about a year after Napster launched. So even though we didn't really stop talking about LimeWire until quite a few years later. Yeah, so what it did was it just connected people's computers. So you had a folder on your computer where you put all your MP3s, and then through the Napster system, your folder of MP3s was connected to other people's folders of MP3s, and anybody who had the software installed on their machine, the machines could talk to each other. There was also a central database that then documented all of the tracks that were stored on all of the computers that had Napster software installed. And actually, the existence of that central database was quite important when it got legal later. So that was how Napster worked. And then once you had two computers connected by this Napster software, one person could go into the system and see, I don't know, who was big in 1999. They could see an NSYNC track and they could say, oh, I want that NSYNC track. It's on all of these other computers that have also got the Napster software installed. And through the software, through the P2P network, I can connect to another computer that has that file on it and make a copy on my computer and listen to NSYNC as often as I like.
Yeah, so like you say, it took off really quickly. It had tens of millions of users within a space of months, and it took everyone behind Napster by surprise. It took the music industry by surprise. I mean, the music industry wasn't really even paying much attention to the internet at the time, certainly hadn't spotted what potential it had or what it could mean for the music industry. They were still very much focused on retail. They had meetings with Napster quite early on, and the meetings were just like, yeah, well, you want to set up this sort of online distribution network, and that's going to piss off the retailers, so we can't really do that. It wasn't like, we think you're breaking the law. That came later. But it really, yeah, the fact that it grew so quickly is what took everyone by surprise. And as far as, I mean, Sean Fanning particularly was always convinced that they were totally on the right side of the law, what they were doing. It never occurred to them that they might be breaking the law. They had legal advice to check that, and the lawyers had said, no, you're fine. And, you know, they were getting investment. They had seasoned executives came in and work for the company. It was a properly incorporated company. It wasn't some shady backstreet thing. And I mean, also, it was really the first time anyone had really done anything like this. So no one really knew what was legal and what wasn't.
I suppose just to stress again, pretty much everything you've just described was happening in the matter of months.
Yeah.
All of this, the explosion online. This isn't,
yeah, exactly.
The investment, the company, the legal advice. This was all within 1999, where, as you say, a few people in the music industry were excited about the potential of the internet. A few artists were already dabbling. Prince was already dabbling with his fan club online. But in the main, most people in the music industry were still in the CD selling business. And it was only really towards the end of 1999 that I think they started to realize that this huge phenomenon that was now occurring, P2P file sharing, of which Napster was the front runner, was going to be a threat. Not only was it going to potentially piss off the retailers, it was going to be a threat to the sale of, well, certainly physical music products on which the record industry was predominantly living.
Yeah, like you say, it was the end of 1999. So it was December 1999 when the US record industry trade body, the RIAA, went and filed legal action against Napster. I mean, and like you say, like that seems, it was, what, 5 months it had been online by then. So it does seem like a fairly quick response, but it had tens of millions of users. It was already massively popular. And I found an interview with Fortune where the then chair of the RIAA, Hillary Rosen, said the record label execs were still not really aware that this was happening or that it was posing any sort of threat. She said she kind of went into an RIAA board meeting with her laptop with Napster on it and just sat there and said, right, just call out the names of songs and we'll see if they're on there. And they're all on there. And it's like catalogue stuff. It's new releases. It's stuff that hasn't been released yet. And that was sort of the moment that they all kind of went, oh, this is not good, is it?
And so the litigation began. And with that initial lawsuit filed against Napster by the RIAA in the American courts, began 15 years of litigation against file sharing companies, software makers, platforms. I say 15 years. I mean, it's still going on now.
And they were suing individual file sharers as well. That was a thing that started with Napster.
Well, that brings us to the legalities of all of this. So as you say, in the summer of 1999, when all of this was still new, no one was quite sure on what the legalities were, and some people were saying that Napster were fine, some people were saying that file sharing was fine. But in this Napster lawsuit, in this legal battle, we heard for the first time what became sort of the classic arguments in the file sharing debate from both the music industry side and the side of the technology companies making the file sharing software. And whereas these days, usually where you have a technology company being accused of infringing copyright in one way or another, what the technology company usually shouts these days, as we know, is safe harbor. We're protected by this thing called the safe harbor in American copyright law or European internet law, and we're fine. We're not liable. But actually, with these early file sharing cases in sort of the late 1990s and mainly in the early 2000s, safe harbor never came up. I don't think anyone had got that far down the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to work out there was this thing called safe harbor that might be useful to more than just the internet service providers that it was really intended for. And so in this case, in the Napster case, and in some subsequent cases in the American courts involving other file sharing companies, we had a totally different defense from the technology side, which was called the Betamax judgment, or the Betamax principle. And that was what Napster argued when this case first came to court.
So what is that?
This Betamax principle.
I mean, if we have to explain Napster to listeners who are too young to know what it is, you're definitely going to have to explain Betamax.
So, in order to understand the arguments...
I mean, you're going to have to explain VHS as well.
To understand the arguments in the Napster litigation in 1999 and 2000, we have to go back to the 1980s, I'm afraid.
The
World Wide Web, pre-file sharing, because that's where some of the precedents that were then used in the Napster case originated. So, Betamax was one of the home video formats. People who don't know what Napster is won't know what home videos are either. But basically, in the 1980s, Sony, who in this period were on the technology side of all of these disputes, because obviously they're an electronics company, whereas obviously once we got to the file sharing era, they were very much on the other side of these debates. But in the 1980s, Sony invented a home video recorder, the Betamax recorder, that lots of people bought, and then the rival format in video, VHS, took off, and Betamax video recorders became redundant.
Skip to the end. It's like streaming, but you hold it in your hand.
I'm not sure that works, but it'll do.
It'll do now.
Let's stick with that. But anyway, when these home video recorders first started being sold massively in the 1980s, Hollywood became really concerned because it now meant that it was much, much easier for people in their homes to start making copies of movie content without permission. And whether that was recording movies off the TV or whether it was putting two video players next to each other and putting a legitimately required video in one player and then recording lots of copies on the other player.
Those were great days.
Anyway.
When you had to spend the entire length of a film playing it in order to rip it off.
Not that we were doing that, because we
of
would never have infringed Hollywood.
I would never have carried the video player from my parents' room downstairs to do that.
So Hollywood was really concerned about that in the 1980s, and so they tried to sue Sony as the maker of the video player by saying that you are helping to facilitate the infringement. Now, obviously, Sony wasn't doing the infringement. Sony wasn't actually sitting down and making copies of the videos. However, in copyright law, there is this thing which in America is generally referred to as contributory infringement or sometimes secondary infringement. Actually, under English law here in the UK, we have a similar concept that we would call authorizing infringement. So every country's copyright law has slightly different ways of dealing with this. So it may be called secondary, contributory, authorizing infringement, but it's all basically based on the same principle, which is to say that let's say you've got an old-fashioned CD bootlegging operation, where somebody is bootlegging CDs. That's clearly direct copyright infringement, what I call primary copyright infringement. No questions asked. If you're taking a CD that you've bought at HMV and then you're sticking it in a machine and you're making another 1,000 of those and then you're selling them at some market on a Saturday morning, that's copyright infringement and you can be sued for that infringement and the record companies would sue you and they would say, okay, you bootlegged, 5,000 CDs. We could have sold those at a record shop if they were legitimate copies for £10 each. So you owe us £50,000 and you would sue for that. And that's all quite straightforward. However, what if the person who's bootlegged the CDs has spent all the money they've made selling those bootleg CDs and now hasn't got any money? If you sue them for £50,000, they haven't got £50,000. So what do you do? So there's this other principle in copyright law that says that people who help with that process, who facilitate that infringement, even if they're not actually involved in the infringement, might also be liable. So to go to my bootleg CD example, If you've got someone selling bootleg CDs at a market every Saturday morning, and the market owner knows what that person is doing, then you could argue the market owner is also liable for the infringement, even though they didn't actually bootleg any CDs.
Yeah.
And we would call that authorizing infringement in this country or contributing infringement in America. And of course, the market owner owns a market.
Yeah.
So they're worth suing.
You can take their market from them.
Because they will have 50 grand that you can go after. So this is a principle that sits in American copyright law. So in the 1980s, when Hollywood was concerned about all these people bootlegging movies on these new Sony Betamax video players, they went to court and they said, OK, Sony isn't involved in this infringement directly. We can't sue them for direct infringement. But we think by selling these devices, they are facilitating the infringement. And therefore, they should be liable for contributory infringement. And so that case went to the American courts in the early 1980s. We had a similar case here in the UK a little bit later in the mid-1980s, which was a music case. When the BPI, the record label trade body, went to court with Alan Sugar.
Good old Alan Sugar.
Because of the Amstrad. This wasn't video, this was the tape-to-tape audio devices. And you mentioned in the early days of tape-to-tape, whether you were tape-to-taping music or movies, the irritating thing was that if it was a two-hour movie, it would take 2 hours to copy.
Yes.
You'd have to literally play it. And then in the mid-80s, on the audio side, Amstrad brought out high-speed dubbing tape-to-tape decks. So now you no longer needed to wait an hour to copy an hour. You could do it in 10 minutes.
And it had two tape decks.
It did.
Ready. You didn't have to go and connect one to the other.
And if you had the volume up while it was doing it, it was sort of playing at super high speed as it recorded it over. So when Amstrad brought those out in the UK, the BPI said, well, the only reason why anyone would want to own one of these, tape to tape with the high speed dubbing, is to infringe the record company's copyright. And so they went to court with Amstrad on similar arguments to the Betamax case in America. And both Hollywood in America and the record industry in the UK lost those cases. And in doing so, set this important precedent that in America became known as the Betamax principle or the Betamax judgment, which was the judges said, well, okay, Sony is selling these video players, but these video players have both legitimate uses and illegitimate uses. You might be buying one of these videos to make copies of your own home videos that you've recorded of your family at the barbecue or whatever.
Want to give them out at Christmas.
Exactly. So these devices have legitimate uses as well as illegitimate uses. And once it has sold you a video player, it has no control over whether or not you use it for legal copying or illegal copying.
They sell them assuming that everyone will abide by the rules.
Of course. And so the technology maker has no control. In the Amstrad case here in the UK, the judges also pointed out that on the side of the boxes of the Amstrad tape-to-tape decks, there was some small print that said, we Amstrad are not authorising you to make any copies. So in the small print on the packaging, Amstrad is saying, don't infringe copyright with our devices. So that was also an important part in the UK case. So we had this principle that said, although there is this thing called contributory infringement or authorising infringement, and people who facilitate infringement may also be held liable for infringement, if the product that a company is selling has both legal and illegal uses, and if that company has no control over how their devices are used, and especially if the communications around those products are not implying that people should use them to infringe copyright, then contributory or authorizing infringement doesn't apply. And so that was the Betamax principle. And that was exactly what Napster argued. When the US record industry took Napster to court, they said, okay, yes, there's this thing called contributory infringement. We know that. But our service has legitimate uses and illegitimate uses. People might be using Napster to distribute their own music.
Yeah.
There may be DIY artists out there, I'm not sure there were in 1999, but there might be, who are sharing their music, which they own, through the Napster system. So we have legitimate uses and illegitimate uses. And once someone has installed the Napster software on their machine, we have no control over whether or not they use it for legal copying or illegal copying. And in our T's and C's, we are not telling people that they can infringe copyright. And so what Napster was basically saying was, if Betamax wasn't liable for infringement back in the 1980s, we can't possibly be liable for infringement right now.
No, although there was one snag in their case was that, as is often the case in these things, Napster had to hand over all their emails to the other side for them to comb through them and see if there's any information that might be useful. And there was a bit. There was an email sent by that Sean Parker, who at one point, unfortunately, said to someone in the company, we need to keep the data that we're pulling in from users anonymous because they don't want to be identified because they're infringing copyright on our system. And the fact that he'd said that was one of the things that built up the case against Napster. And one of the reasons that actually the initial hearing, the RIAA got a ruling in their favour to get an injunction against Napster while the case was ongoing, which then Napster quite quickly got overturned on appeal. But Napster, having been quite confident going in, were a bit shaken by the speed at which the judge went, I think the record industry's got a point.
Although, as you said at the outset, at these early stage of this, bearing in mind all of this is happening so quickly, it wasn't completely clear which side was going to win. And so, yes, the RIAA got their injunction, but then they lost their injunction because initially the judges weren't really ruling one way or the other. In fact, at one point, it looked like they were going to err on the Napster side and say, actually, we think you've got a point. The Betamax principle does apply. But that database that you were talking about, that Sean Parker was concerned about what was going on in there, ended up being absolutely crucial to the final ruling, which happened in the appeals court in America, which is the one which basically sided with the record industry. And that database was key, because although what Sean Parker was concerned about there was the fact that if people's names were listed in that database next to the music that they were sharing, then they could be sued for infringement, because for definite, that was direct infringement. I say for definite, actually, in quite a few countries, particularly in Southern Europe, it was debated in court whether or not even the individuals were liable for copyright infringement. Although generally in the US and the UK, that bit was uncontroversial in legal terms. But the database was key because remember what the Betamax principle said, which was that once Betamax has sold a video player, it has no control over what happens to that video player. And so what the record industry finally said, and the judges agreed on this, was, well, hang on a second. Once the Napster software has been installed, that bit of software is then pumping all this data back to this central database. And even though, as Sean Parker has said, it may not be providing information on who is sharing the content, it is definitely sharing the information of what content is being shared. And so this database says there's all this Britney Spears music, there's all this NSYNC music, there's all this,
Metallica
music, obviously. Quite opinionated on this. And Napster can see this. So they do have control. Because what Napster could be doing is going through this database, and where they see people are sharing music without license, they could do something about it. Now, whether or not that is cutting those people off, or actually what was mainly discussed was introducing filters so that if a track came in with Britney Spears as the artist and Britney Spears' label was saying, we don't want our music to be shared, maybe the system would automatically delete it. Of course, this is before the days of talking about audio recognition technology. If that did start to happen, people would just catch on to that and stop putting the artist's name in the artist's name field.
Well, that is what happened.
Although, of course, that would make the experience more irritating, wouldn't it, for users, because then it wouldn't be as easy to use. So anyway, what the court said was you do have control over what happens to your software after it has been downloaded. So on that point, we are going to say that the Betamax principle does not apply. It's not that we are deleting the Betamax principle. It's not that we're changing the law. We are simply saying because you have control to an extent over what happens to your content, then you can't rely on that defense. So you are liable for contributory copyright infringement.
Yes. And that final ruling came in the summer of 2001. So we're talking, you know, it's 2 years that this company existed and eventually went out of business. But in that time, because obviously this is such a short period of time, I mean, Napster did, you know, they'd always thought of themselves as a legit company, and at some point kind of realised that, well, maybe, you know, this isn't really, our arguments aren't going our way, this is looking a bit shaky, we should at least try to do deals with the music business. And Napster's argument for the music business doing deals, even before the music industry realised that, you know, Napster might be a problem, was that we've got this new type of music distribution network, we're pulling in all this data about what people like and, you know, connecting artists together, and, you know, this huge amount of data that you could use to sell more music. And, you know, and initially they just talked about doing partnerships. They didn't talk about licensing deals. But once legal action started, they started trying to license the product, and they talked about doing a legitimate, properly licensed version of Napster. But as often happens in these cases, once the record industry had gone legal, it kind of wasn't really interested in listening anymore. So they did have meetings with all the major labels where they put forward those arguments, and the labels just kind of went, I think we're probably just going to sue you out of business.
It was an interesting time because in the main, the labels were all speaking as one on this, or certainly the major labels were. I think there were a handful of detractors in the indie labels, but generally speaking, the record companies were like, yeah, this is a big problem, we need to do something about it. The artist community was more divided, that some artists, I mean, you mentioned obviously Metallica.
Metallica sued Napster themselves, because when they discovered how much of their music was being shared.
So some artists were very much on the side of the record companies, but there were other artists who were saying, we think this is really cool, and okay, yeah, it may be an issue, we may need to work some stuff out, but we think this is the future, yeah, and we should be getting
Chuck
involved
D,
in this.
Being a prime one, former CMU columnist Chuck D.
At the time.
At the very time, yes. He spoke in front of a committee at the US House of Representatives in favour of Napster, saying that this was potentially a really big and positive thing for the music industry and it should be protected. So yeah, it was the artists were a lot more split than the labels that generally focus on, except
with one exception.
One exception, BMG, then a major label. This is before it merged with Sony, and before, well, the BMG now is a different company than the BMG then. But yeah, BMG was one of the five major labels then. That's another thing younger listeners won't even believe. There used to be five major labels.
There had been six not long before this story.
But BMG kind of had been with the rest of the major labels in saying, yes, Napster is bad, we should fight. And then had a change of tune. And in February 2001, so, you know, 5-6 months before the end of Napster, did come up with a plan. It went into business with Napster. It loaned Napster $20 million initially. I don't know if we know the exact fit. I've seen as much as $60 million in total being lent to Napster by BMG to keep it afloat during this legal action, because the legal action was obviously very expensive. It was having problems paying its expensive lawyers and having, I mean, they were having to buy more and more servers. Like, the number of servers they were having to buy, like, on a weekly basis was huge, just to keep up with the growing demand for this service. But yeah, BMG kind of suddenly changed its tune and went, no, we're going to help you out. We reckon you do have a positive thing to offer. This probably is exciting. Maybe, yeah, you do need to work some things out. So here's the money to keep you going for the moment. They offered the RIAA a $1 billion settlement if it dropped its legal action and allowed Napster to carry on as it was, which the RIAA rejected. But yeah, that's quite unusual, isn't it? God, that's another, this is one of the things I'd forgotten, that there was a label that was just like, no, we think it's all right.
And by this point, because as we say, neither Sean Fanning nor Sean Parker ever saw themselves as being in...
Sean Parker had left the company
at
this point.
But neither of them ever saw themselves as being in conflict with the music industry at the start. And towards the end, Sean Fanning, once it became clear that the legal arguments were starting to turn against them, there was going to be this judgment that was going to say, because you're not filtering files as the metadata associated with them gets added to your database, and you're not employing the control you have over how your software is used, you're going to be liable for infringement. Sean Fanning was very much, well, let's try and employ these filters. And we know they're not going to be perfect. Nobody thinks they're going to be perfect, but what can we do? And that was one of the things that BMG were helping to fund. Because he was desperately trying to work out, okay, how can I make Napster
compliant?
Well,
it was also the ultimate injunction against Napster was that it wasn't that you have to shut down. It was that you can carry on going, but you have to make sure there's no infringing content on your system. Which, I mean, Sean Fanning and the other bosses at Napster went to their engineers and were like, okay, let's set up this system that will filter out all the infringing content. And they were like, that's not possible. And they were like, going to have to try anyway. So, they did start trying to do that. They built things that would look for infringing content and look for, you know, misspellings of artist names, trying to get around that. And they tried to pull stuff off. But like you said earlier, the users quickly worked out. It's just like, well, if you just don't put an artist name up, then they can't track that artist name. They found ways around it, and it didn't really stop the file sharing at all.
I mean, I think some of the techie people did at the time say, in the future, we might actually be able to do some sort of audio recognition, which obviously is subsequent what has happened with things like YouTube Content ID. And Sean Fanning was talking about that at one point. So yes, the techies were saying this isn't going to work in the short term, but maybe somewhere in the future there'll be a better system. Although the lawyers and even the record industry, they weren't suggesting that this was going to be some sort of panacea, that it was going to stop it. I think what the judges were ultimately saying to Napster is, you're not even trying. And the fact you're not even trying is why we're going to make you liable. So then, had Napster survived and had it introduced some of these filters, which, let's say, best case scenario, they'd had something like a 10% hit rate and 90% of the infringing content was still going through, it would have been fascinating to then see subsequent cases in court where Napster would have said, well, we're doing as much as we can. We think we're compliant with the court order, even though all this infringement is continuing. But of course, none of that happened, because despite BMG lending them all this money, they ran out of cash.
Yes.
And so the case never got to Supreme Court. It was an appeal court ruling, and they never got to get these filters properly sorted because Napster, the company, went bankrupt.
Yes, they sort of hoped that, you know, by trying to comply with this impossible task of filtering content, it would at least buy them some time to work out a new model that would monetize it in a way that would allow them to keep going. But yeah, that didn't happen. They ran out of money. They filed for bankruptcy protection. And then on the 1st of July, 2001, just over 2 years after they switched their servers on, they switched them all off again. And that was the end of Napster. I think the company attempted to struggle on and find a new way of doing things for a matter of days or weeks after that. But ultimately, yeah, they had to throw in the towel and search for a buyer.
Yes, and what they were selling in essence was the Napster brand. But
yes,
the original,
they couldn't sell the technology.
The original Napster, the file-sharing Napster, what we're really here to talk about today, was over, as you say, just over 2 years, that all of that action was happening. And then in the years that followed, I guess there were three other strands to what followed after the bankruptcy, after the end of the original Napster. First of all, Sean Fanning continued to be quite vocal. He was involved in a number of other startups.
Snowcat.
He was trying to do some of the early fingerprinting and audio ID and metadata technology. So that whole idea of the filtering, he sort of focused on that for a bit longer, hoping to develop a technology that would do that. So that was sort of strand number one. Then you had strand number two, which was what precedent had the Napster ruling set? Was this ruling now saying that all file-sharing software was liable for copyright infringement under American law? Most of the other file-sharing companies insisted it didn't set a precedent for one key reason, which is that actually Napster was quite unusual in having this central database where all the tracks were logged. Most other file-sharing systems didn't do that. And the next big case to go to court was against a company called Grokster, and it didn't have a central database. So its legal argument, and this case went all the way to Supreme Court, was we don't have a central database. So that control that you said that Napster had, we clearly don't have. So the Betamax principle should apply to us. But ultimately, Grokster lost, partly because that argument didn't wash. They were saying, okay, yes, there's not a central database, but you could still put some filters into the software. So as data goes from one computer to another, you could be monitoring that. Also, Grokster got into trouble for some of the ways they talked about their service and the allegation that they had been suggesting to their users very heavily that they might want to infringe some copyrights but with the software. So there was a communication element too. But then once the Grokster case had been decided in the Supreme Court, found against Grokster, most of the other US-based file-sharing services providing similar software turned off almost overnight and went off the market, with the exception of the aforementioned LimeWire. And this was LimeWire's moment, because all these other services turned off and LimeWire mopped up all of their user bases, which is how LimeWire subsequently became the big player. Although in between that, we had the rise of Kazaa. Do you remember Kazaa?
Kazaa.
Which for a couple of years was the file sharing network of choice. It originally had been set up in Europe, had been sued by one of the collecting societies in Europe, and on the back of that had reset itself up on a tiny little island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So Kazaa was really interesting because it was deliberately set up to be impossible to sue. However, you have to have an office somewhere. They had their offices in Australia, so subsequently we had the Kazaa case in Australia. All the same cases were presented, the same ruling was given, which was that Kazaa must have filters on their software, use that control, otherwise they would be liable for authorizing infringement. So actually the Kazaa case was interesting from a UK perspective, because UK and Australian copyright law are much more closely aligned. Ultimately, LimeWire got sued. It said, we have legitimate uses and illegitimate uses, we have no control. They employed all the same arguments, despite the fact that they'd all fallen apart in the Napster and the Grokster cases. Eventually, LimeWire was also sued out of business. But by this point, we're in the late 2000s, and by this point, nobody was using any of those file-sharing networks anymore. It was all about BitTorrent file-sharing, hence the rise of the Pirate Bay, which brings us to another one of these special editions that we're going
we'll
to be doing
that soon.
At some point in the next few months. So we sort of pause the file-sharing story there and say we'll come back to that when we get to the Pirate Bay story on another edition. The third strand of post-Napster bankruptcy that we should give a quick mention to as we wrap up this edition is what happened to the Napster name.
Well, yes, and well, there's a whole load of interesting stuff about that, and sort of in between it actually getting sold, because once they'd shut off the servers, the first buyer they went to, or the first potential buyer, was BMG, because obviously they were already in business with BMG. BMG had loaned them all this money. BMG was the obvious buyer, it was seen as the favourite, and you know, it was kind of expected that that would happen. So this goes back to what you were saying before, when the person you're suing for damages over copyright infringement has no money, who else do you go after? And in the case of this, the major labels all went after BMG, sued them and said, when you loaned Napster all that money, you took a stake in the business and therefore you're liable now for those damages.
Yeah, the key argument in that interesting case that rumbled on for quite a bit
after the closure
of Napster was that by loaning them all that money, you kept Napster in business for another, I don't know, 6 months, say, maybe a little bit longer than that. And so therefore, we're going to hold you liable for all the infringement that happened in those 6 months, because had you not given them that money, they would have gone bankrupt 6 months earlier, and then we would all have been saved all of the infringement that had gone. I mean, they wouldn't have been. The infringement would have just happened on Grokster. But that was sort of the argument the other labels were giving against one of their counterparts, against BMG.
BMG argued that that just isn't how these things work. Just because we loaned someone some money doesn't mean we now owe you damages. And anyway, the terms of our deal over those loans were that, yes, we would take a stake in the company, but only if and when Napster created a fully licensed file sharing service, which of course it never did. So BMG was like, we wash our hands of it. Ultimately, the end of that long-running court case was that they settled out of court, but BMG ended up handing over a lot of money to the other majors. It was $60 million to Universal. EMI's settlement was undisclosed. Warner Music, a year later, took $110 million as a settlement over that case. So that didn't quite go in BMG's favour.
The merger of Sony, I think, helped settle that particular part of the dispute. But yeah, that was another thing that rumbled on. But as you say, BMG had been fought initially as, okay, if there's one company that's going to take the brand, take the momentum, take the audience and do something with this, it'll be BMG. But with all of that legal wrangling, that wasn't to happen.
And in fact, there was a court order that specifically blocked BMG from buying Napster, which is what ultimately led to their assets being liquidated. There were various other buyers in the line. There was a Spanish porn company who were talking about buying it. But ultimately, it went to Roxio, who made and still make CD and DVD burning software. So they bought the name Napster and the URL Napster.com for $5.3 million. And then they also bought a licensed, legitimate download service called Press Play. And they basically just rebadged that.
Yeah, so Press Play is quite interesting. This is all pre the iTunes store, we have to remember.
Yes.
So there weren't really any proper, fully-fledged, mainstream legal download services available, although people were trying to launch them. So in addition to the file-sharing thing that was going on over here, there were people trying to launch licensed download stores, and eMusic had been going for quite some time, but only really working with the indie labels. We have things like PeopleSound, who are mainly working with DIY artists. But the majors all tried to launch their own download stores.
Yes.
And so I can't quite remember what the partnerships were. They sort of split themselves up and three of them tried to launch one.
Press Play was Universal and Sony.
So the other three...
So slightly ironically, a service set up by Universal and Sony became Napster.
And the other three also had their own rival to Press Play. But yeah, so this company, Roxio, did two deals, got the Napster name, got the Press Play platform, and then launched, eventually, a legal download service using the Napster name.
It was a subscription service. It wasn't, you know, like an a la carte service like iTunes. It was you paid $15 a month and you got access to a database, I mean, streaming database as well as downloads of really low quality audio files. You could download some of them and you were allowed to burn 10 of them a month to CD.
So that was how the original Napster download service worked. And this was the period when iTunes Store was just emerging and we were still debating, how will the download market work? Will it be ownership based? So it's like a record shop, you download tracks, they're the heirs for your life. Or will it be subscription based like the Napster service you've just described? Obviously, when it came to downloads, and the download market that then dominated for the rest of the 2000s, the ownership model that iTunes instigated succeeded, the model Napster pursue failed. And the main reason for that was the iPod took off. And all of these subscription services, like what Napster trying to get off the ground, or there was the MyCoke music download store before that.
Well, also another issue was obviously iTunes. You bought your track, you downloaded it. Hooray, now I've got music. With Press Play, one of the real drawbacks to it, aside from the files not being very good quality, was that anything you downloaded was DRM'd. There's another future episode of our 20th anniversary series. And the downloads expired 30 days after you downloaded them. You'd have to download them again if you wanted them as part of your monthly allowance.
But as I alluded to, in addition to all of that crap, it didn't work on an iPod.
Yeah.
So you'd have to have another kind of MP3 player that played probably some sort of Microsoft system. And all those early Microsoft download systems were really rubbish. And remember, there was that whole period where if you had an MP3 player that wasn't an iPod, and this is even pre-Microsoft Zune, but there were other MP3 players on the market, it really felt inferior to having the iPod. And so, iTunes Store became the download store.
The iAudio X5 was was superior to all MP3 players.
That was the one the cool kids had.
Yeah.
So anyway,
still got mine somewhere.
The legit Napster download store never really took off. iTunes exploded. But Napster still exists because what Napster did, once it had rejected that quirky download system that it was proposing, it ultimately reinvented itself as a streaming service in the late 2000s as the streaming market started to take off. And actually, if we're being honest, even though we were sort of mocking Napster's slightly complicated subscription download service it was trying to push in the early 2000s, That is what offline listening on Spotify is. We just don't call it that anymore. So there was a parallel between what Napster were doing then and what Spotify and Apple Music are doing now. But Napster ultimately reinvented itself as a streaming service, and it still exists. There have been various changes in ownership.
Yeah, it got spun off as a publicly listed company by Roxio, and then in 2008 it was acquired by Best Buy for $121 million. So that was actually, you know, quite a good return on their initial $5.3 million purchase. I don't think they actually made them a profit, because I think it made mostly losses. And then there was another deal in 2011 when it was acquired by the then leading US streaming service, Rhapsody, Best Buy giving a minority stake in that company. They merged the two companies. They dropped the Napster name in the US and it just carried on as Rhapsody, because Rhapsody was the kind of market leader at the time.
It having originally spun out of Real Networks, if you remember Real Networks.
Real Networks. But then in Europe, Napster was better known. And Rhapsody had never launched outside the US, and Napster was available elsewhere, so they kept it in Europe particularly, and they expanded a lot in Europe, and it became a lot bigger. I mean, it did all right, and to the point where actually eventually the Rhapsody name was dropped and it became Napster everywhere, and continues to this day. So Napster is not dead.
Although while you said that it was doing all right in Europe, and then obviously as Rhapsody and subsequently rebranded Napster in the US, it may have been doing all right, but then once...
It wasn't doing Spotify all right.
Once the Spotify explosion took off and Spotify started to boom, and then obviously Apple Music subsequently came along, Napster ended up being one of those smaller streaming services with at most a few million subscribers. And actually, in more recent years, most Napster subscribers are probably on a bundle with a mobile phone. That's how they end up with it. And yeah, it is now, although it continues to exist, it's continued to be bundled into mobile phones somewhere. It does live on as one of the very small streaming services that, if we're being honest, when people talk about streaming, it's the one they often forget to put in their list.
Yeah, if you mention Napster, people are going to think illegal file sharing service. They're not going to think very exciting streaming service that lots of people use.
But even though the Napster we were here to talk about today ended 2 years after its launch, the brand and the service does live on, so we must remember that and not completely write them off.
No, like MySpace, it's a rise and fall story where the fall has not completely hit the ground. It's sort of just plateaued.
Although, to be fair to Napster,
although Napster's, I think
they're doing a bit better than MySpace.
Doing better than MySpace. Okay, fair enough. I mean, that's damning with faint praise, isn't it? Doing better than MySpace. Well done. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week. If you've enjoyed this, please do tell your friends, especially if they're young and don't know what Napster is, because everyone should know what Napster is. The Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU, presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.